Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Really, 007. Welcome everyone to the Really 007 podcast for this very special episode where we will be chatting to Bond author extraordinaire Charlie Higson. Charlie will be known to many of you as an actor, comedian, singer, writer, director and author of 5 young Bond novels. And now he's released his first adult Bond novel on His Majesty's Secret Service. And we can't wait to discuss all these amazing achievements and more with Charlie right now. There are various places you can find our podcast to listen in and follow, including YouTube, iTunes and Spotify, and our website with our Poddojo Media Network. A special shout out for this one to a friend of the show and huge fan of Bond novels from the original Flemings, right up to the Higson. It's David Lowbridge Ellis, aka Licence to Queer. Charlie, how the devil are you? It is an absolute pleasure to meet you today.
Well, likewise. Yes, I always enjoy talking about... Well, I always enjoy talking about myself, obviously, but I also do very much enjoy talking about Bond. And I think it's a passion that's shared by quite a lot of people.
It absolutely is. When was the first time you think that you became a James Bond fan? What was the moment when you thought, oh, my God, I absolutely love this guy and this world?
Well, the first film that I ever remember going to see in the cinema was Thunderball when it first came out. And I must have been to the cinema before then, but that's the one that really stuck in my mind. You know, it felt like a real event, you know, big screen. Back then, this is the early 60s, all the screens were big screens. They hadn't been chopped up into tiny little things. So you'd go there, huge, great cinema, and there'd be a circle upstairs and stalls downstairs, and, you know, the music comes blasting out. And this was just about the most exciting thing that had ever happened to me. And I remember it must have been very soon after it came out, because I got a sort of booklet like you'd get at a cinema, like a program with a load of photographs and interviews and bits and pieces in it, which I wish I'd kept, because, as you know, these things do seem to accumulate some value. But it's lost in the mist of time. But I would spend a lot of time poring over that and kind of reliving the film. And it just felt very exciting. And, you know, I'd obviously watch lots of TV where you'd get a certain type of hero in something. And James Bond felt very, very different. He was quite dark. He did some quite nasty things in that film, you know, like in the nightclub scene where he effectively uses a woman as a sort of human shield and then makes a little quip about her as he sits her down at someone's table. What does he say something like, I think she's had too much?
Dead.
She's just dead.
Oh, is that really what he says?
She's just dead. I didn't ever really think it was a quip. I thought it was just like a statement of fact. Like, yep, she's literally dead.
Well, yeah. You know, and, but, well, I mean, yeah, that sums up Bond and that, well, 1960s Bond, and that sums up that film, you know. And so for me, after that, going to the cinema in the 60s sort of meant going to see James Bond. You know, the films were always on and the old films would always come back and be repeated. So yeah, I mean, it was only years later when I was in my 20s that I got around to reading the books. So for me, it was Sean Connery in the 60s.
Right. And did the books sort of like... Was it like did it reinvigorate the love or supercharge the love? Or because for me, when I read the books, it was like, whoa, this is obviously a lot different from the films and a lot much more of a harder edge. And you could go into a lot more details about the character. And I always loved like the small details, like what the character ate and stuff like that.
Yes.
Did it just open the world up for you?
Well, it did. I mean, also the books, there's a sort of strangeness in the books that you don't get in the films. I mean, you know, some of the more outrageous Roger Moore ones, perhaps. You know, it's like, you know, if you're reading Dr. No for the first time, having seen the film, you're really not expecting Bond to have a fight with a giant squid kept in a cage.
Yes.
And you kind of think, this is quite bizarre. And, you know, I was instantly struck with how well written the books are in terms of the energy and the excitement, and you know, Fleming was supremely good at writing about action and doing things. And you know, he also said that he thought the success of the books was down to the fact that he had an adolescent mind. And there's a lot of that in the films where you can see he's just sort of enjoying something that you could say, well, this is like a kid's book. So it's got that yeah. sort of balance of being very adult and, as you say, quite hard-edged and dark, but also there will be these sort of mad flights of fantasy that he just enjoyed, you know, like the Spang brothers in Diamonds Are Forever traveling around on this kind of Wild West steam train, which is ridiculous, but you know, Fleming liked it, so he put it in.
And what about, so we've got the love of Bond, but like, what about yourself as a storyteller? I mean, you know, the amount of there is a huge body of work that you've compiled here. For those that don't know, we were discussing just before we press record, is it about the 23-24 bookmark for you now?
Well, it's something like that if you count absolutely everything that I worked on that ended up in a book. Yes. I mean, they're not all lengthy novels. And, you know, they range from, you know, a picture book, kids books for younger kids, right through to the young James Bond, and then books for teenagers, and obviously my adult books, of which I've written quite a few now. So, yes, body of work, I think you described it as. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I think in the game we call it bibliography in a way, don't we? I think I don't. I've never been brave enough to call anything like that, to be honest.
If you like, but I can't remember what was the actual question
about your origins as a storyteller. I mean, were you right, a reader as a kid? Were you always a big reader?
Yeah. I mean, I loved reading, and you know, when I was growing up, there was nothing else to do really. You know, you'd get like an hour of kids' TV a day. On the TV, no computers or games consoles, no internet, none of that. So yeah, you went outside and played, or you read books and comics, which anyway, and I did all of those things. Yeah, I mean, I loved reading and I loved writing. I started writing from quite an early age because it seemed to me to be a sort of magic that you could take a pencil and a piece of paper, and just by making those kind of weird squiggly marks on the paper, suddenly a whole world comes alive, characters come alive, and you know, they're walking and talking, and they can make you laugh or cry, or you know, you want to kill them. And I just thought, well, this is extraordinary that this process awakes in people's minds these thoughts, and you somehow can send your thoughts directly through these scribbles into someone's mind, and you can do that across time and space. And I just loved that idea of creativity, of making things up. And when I became a teenager, I very much got into sci-fi and fantasy. So I wrote a lot of sort of fantasy books and, you know, making up languages and things when I was supposed to be doing my homework. and I never showed it to anybody because really I didn't because I liked making things up. And to spent my life and have got a job being paid to make things up has been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I could try and explain to someone else what the power of writing can do, and how it costs nothing to write, does it? You know, it's like, you just said, a pencil, a piece of paper, and you're off and you're away. And the power in writing, I love just what you just said there, because it's something that I totally believe in as well, you know. And the fact that, you know, you get to make stories and connect with people. It's an ancient thing, isn't it? Storytelling is a way of comforting, of sharing knowledge. It's a societal thing that we all do and we always have done. Oh, it's awesome. Were there any particular books that you were really into growing up? I know you mentioned sci-fi, but was there any book that changed everything for you?
Well, I mean, in the 60s, it was a heyday of historical fiction for kids. There were loads of great writers. I mean, some of them are still sort of read a bit, like Mary Renault or whatever, but there were loads of them, like Geoffrey Treese and Henry Treese. I devoured them. And actually, funnily enough, I was reading, is it called Maurice Druon, I think, a French author who wrote a series of books, the first of which is The Iron King, which is about, it's historical fiction in medieval France, but the introduction was written by, he's not J.R.R., George Martin, George R.R.R.R. Martin.
Oh, yeah.
Not J.R.R.R. Tolkien.
I thought you were going to say J.R. Hartley from the...
J.R. Hartley, yes. it's an extremely long-winded shaggy dog joke. No, and he said there's a huge correlation between historical fiction and fantasy fiction. And he said that people who like one tend to like the other. And obviously, famously, Game of Thrones is sort of inspired by English history, particularly the Wars of the Roses. So I was really into historical fiction. And then I got into fantasy fiction via Lord of the Rings and Michael Moorcock. And in my early teenage years, that's what I read, you know, a lot of. And then got into more of the sort of sci-fi area. I always loved was a story that would take me out of my own boring, dull little life in a little, you know, where I lived and going to school, and would take me on an adventure, take me somewhere else, time and space or you know, fantastical worlds. I loved that. I had no interest in reading like stories about, you know, school stories or, you know, football stories or anything like that. I wanted fantasy and adventure and to go out there. And you know, I think that's one of the reasons we love James Bond and those early James Bond books, you know, in the drab 50s where England is still recovering from the war. There is still rationing. Nobody has much money. Suddenly these adventures come where James Bond is traveling around the world, meeting beautiful women, extraordinary villains, and eating, as you mentioned earlier, fantastic food. You know, there was a huge fantasy element to Bond, which is sometimes forgotten today.
Like kimchi, Charlie.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I... yes, I mean, in my book, in my Bond book on His Majesty's Secret Service, yes, but Bond is getting into food that is good for a healthy gut, because he relies on a gut sense and gut feeling to give him a fraction of a second advantage over the enemy. He's letting his primitive thinking gut act before his slow working, meticulous frontal brain. And so, yeah, he's eating kimchi and drinking kombucha. And why not? You know, Fleming would have been fascinated by that kind of thing. He always was. And he always was searching out exotic and interesting things for Bond to eat and drink.
Of course, wasn't it in the Thunderball novel where he's literally, he's been sent to Scrublands, obviously, and his Bond is so depressed with what he's being made to eat and all that kind of stuff, and M's making him do it and all that kind of thing. And they have that brilliant back and forth about it all. And you were absolutely right. Fleming would have loved all that stuff. Absolutely.
Well, totally. You know, he was fascinated by what was going on in the world and what was going on around him, and he was always looking for new things and different things to write about. So,
your first three novels, King of the Ants, Happy Now, and Full Whack, all come together around the same time as your TV comedy career is really sort of exploding. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I started getting into comedy writing in the late 80s. I'd been friends of Paul Whitehouse since we'd met at university in 1977. we'd done various other things, but, you know, we'd always made each other laugh. And another friend we'd met over the years was Harry Enfield, and he was starting to do performances where he needed people to write with him. And so Paul and I started to write with him, and then we ended up writing for Stavros and then co-creating loads of money for Saturday Night Live, which became Friday Night Live.
Oh, you! Shut your mouth and look at my wad! Loads of money!
This is a journey into money. Loads of money.
And yes, yeah, so I was getting into comedy, but I was writing. I'd always been writing books,
right?
And you know, as I say, not showing them to publishers, but I did eventually get round to writing a crime book, which became King of the Ants, and so that was happening right through then. And there was a fourth book actually called Getting Rid of Mr. Kitchen, and
yes,
you know, it. But things were sort of becoming difficult. I remember desperately trying to finish Getting Rid of Mr. Kitchen before my first child was born.
Right.
And thinking, I've got to get this out of the way because things are going to change. And also, Paul and I had been working on Harry Enfield television program in the early 90s. It's his first sketch show that he was doing.
Yeah.
It just got to a point where it was too much work. I mean, writing a novel is a lot of work and you don't get paid very much money for it. But writing TV, particularly if you're writing with someone else, as I was with Paul, can be a bit quicker, but it also pays a lot more. So really, the 1984, which I think, well, 1984 was the first, 1984 was when the Fast Show launched the first series. So that sort of brought a full stop to me having time to work on books and to give it proper attention, because Paul and I ended up not only writing it, but also performing in it, but we were also producing in it. So, so, you know, most writers on a comedy thing, you'll write for 3 or 4 months of the year or whatever, and then the rest of the year you can do something else. You can write something else, you can work on something else. But for us, it was taking us a year nonstop every day to make a series, because we were there at the beginning of the writing process, then we went through the whole putting it all together and filming it, and then we're there for the edit. So it's a long process, and then as soon as we finish one series, we would start on the next. So there was absolutely no way you can fit in writing a novel.
Just in terms of the writing process, Charlie, so obviously you're writing novels and coming up with the ideas yourself, and then you've also got this TV comedy writing kind of, presumably those are completely different processes. One is collaborative, and one is, you know, you on your own. Or are there things that, you know, you can, I don't know, things that you can pick up from one that you can put into the other? Or are they just completely, did you keep them completely separate, and do you continue to do so?
Well, no, it's an interesting question. I mean, in the end, it's the same process. It's writing. It is using words to create worlds or whatever, to create something that wasn't there before. The big difference is if you write a novel, when you finished it's done, it's there. There's more stages to the process of getting it published and in the shops and for people to know that it exists and to actually buy it and read it, which is quite hard to get them to do that. But when they do, they simply have to open the book. And as I said before, my thoughts, my words are going straight into the head, and they are creating in their heads everything else. Now, if you're screenwriting, it's a very different process. In a sense, you know, a script is like a blueprint for a finished thing. And, you know, if your script is not filmed, whether it's TV or film or everything, it doesn't really exist. And people have very little interest in reading scripts of things that were never made. So it's a blueprint. And you have then got to get in huge teams of people to make that a thing. You've got to get actors and costume and makeup. You've got to have designers who are going to build all the sets, location managers to find the places you're going to go and film. You've got a camera team, a sound team, and all the office staff. It's a huge, huge undertaking. They are doing all the work that if you write a book, the reader is just does in their head.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can write a book in which an army of 10,000 knights charge off a cliff, but you know, if you write in a script, someone's got to find 12,000 knights to ride off a cliff.
Yeah.
I mean, CGI is changing a lot of that, but it's still a vast undertaking. And both of them are huge fun. I mean, the nice thing about writing a book is yes, you have editors and copy editors and whatever, but essentially it's you. You're there. You're doing all of that. You are, you know, casting director, producer, director, the whole thing. And you can tell any story you like. And there aren't really any restrictions on what you can write about, and where it can go and what it can be. But it can be, well, it is a very solitary process. It's just you at your computer by yourself with your imaginary friends. Now, I mean, I quite like that. I'm quite happy with that. But, you know, it can be lonely and it can be quite draining because you are relied on for everything. Everything has got to be squeezed out of your head. And what's nice about filming is it is a collaborative process. Mm-hmm. So you're going in, you know, back in the day, Paul and I, if we're making a fast show, we go into the fast show office at the BBC, which is full of people working with you, for you. And, you know, you'll be working with all of those creative people. There's a fantastic part in William Goldman's book. What's the first one called?
Not sure.
Well, William Goldman, the great Hollywood screenwriter who wrote the likes of Butcher Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Yeah. Marathon Man. I've got it on the shelf here somewhere.
I can never find anything on my shelf.
But anyway. Adventures in the Screen Trade. William Goldman in Adventures in the Screen Trade, there's a great bit at the end where he's got, you know, he's talked about, you know, the screenwriter being, you know, what it's like to be a screenwriter in this process. And he said, you know, this has all been about me and being a screenwriter, but it doesn't really work like that. And there's a bit where he's got a little short story and he's saying, let's go through the process of trying to get it made. And he goes and talks to a director and he talks to a, you know, a producer and he talks to a set designer and they're all saying, well, yeah, we can do this scene like this and we do this like that. And, you know, it is very interesting about that collaborative process. And if it's a good collaborative process and you're working with clever, creative people, they will all be bringing something to it. They'll be helping you solve problems. They'll be coming up with new ideas, different ways of doing it. And then when you get the actors involved, they will all bring something of their own to it. And then you've got the music you can add and all that stuff. So you're not, it's not just you. And so it has been fantastic over the years to just keep switching between the two.
Hello there. This is Thomas Wheatley, or I should say Saunders, Section B, Vienna. Now you're listening to Really 007. I'm under the impression you're the best, so do listen.
It would be remiss of us to say, wouldn't it, particularly Rob, when we were growing up, we were probably like 11, 12 when Harry Enfield's programmes came out. I know you'd done stuff with Reeves and Mortimer, which we adore. And then the Fast Show, there was like a group of us in our class. We were probably that absolute peak age, like 13.
Yeah.
A lot of it is very, very silly. There's a bit of satire in it. And especially some of the ones you've done as Harry and Paul was a bit more satirical, wasn't it? But honestly, Charlie, some of these characters that you've created, I mean, I was thinking one of them, of course, is not Ian Fleming, but Barb Fleming.
Barb Fleming, yes. obviously, a nod to Ian there.
Was it right?
Well, yeah. I mean, no, I was a Fleming fan, and you know, it was the perfect name for him because of the Flem part.
Fleming, of course. Yeah.
Really, not much to choose between these two guns, in terms of action and accuracy, but you you will notice a marked difference in weight. the gun on my left here, the box lock is the gun on my left here, the gun on my left here, the box light.
And you know, my character of Swiss Tony was also he was kind of obsessed with James Bond. And when I originally did the voice on, it was actually on Smell of Rose and Mortimer. I did Swiss Tony first.
Yes, yeah.
It was my terrible attempt to do Sean Connery.
Customer, Tony. As a customer, she's a girl, a woman. Oh, she's beautiful. She wants to ask you about the Peugeot.
What would be your ideal night out with a lady, Paul?
Tony, she's in a hurry. She wants to ask you about the Peugeot.
Never pressurise the customer.
Yeah, but she, honestly...
Let her look. She may find something she likes better. Something more expensive.
Yeah, Tony, honestly...
So tell me, your ideal night out.
I don't know. Maybe we'd go down the pub and then...
No, no. Can I stop you there? You see, you've fallen at the first fence. You do not take a lady down the pub. You take her to the finest restaurant in town, where you eat only the best food, freshly prepared by an award-winning chef. You drink fine wines. Then you take her to your hotel. Best hotel in town, mind. You carry her up to your room, where there are Belgian chocolates, more fine wines, quality champagne on ice, satin sheets on the bed, maybe a poem on the pillow, a single red rose. Then slowly and gently, you undress her. But keep your own clothes on, because nobody likes to see a man in the nude. Then you do together what men and women have done since the dawn of time. Oh, you must make her feel that what you are doing there has never been done before.
She's going, Tony. Tony, she's going.
Let her go. Sometimes you've just got to have the courage to let a woman go out of your life. Let her go.
You can't just...
For God's sake, Paul, do you not realise I am having a nervous breakdown?
Me and my brother, Charlie, we can't get through a Sunday tea. You know, if anything on the table is a tiny little bit burnt, it's like at the edge of this sausage, it almost looks a little... Johnny Nice Painter.
Yes, and, you know, and you know, there's a lot, he was one of my favourite characters and great fun
He's just incredible.
Yeah.
Love the sound of the seagulls, don't you, Katie?
It's very evocative, isn't it?
It's a lovely sound. Now, I'm just putting some more blue in the water there. Do you notice as the day goes on, the colour of the sea changes almost by the minute, doesn't it?
It's a wonderful blue, isn't it?
It is lovely. And the reds of the roofs there against the water really jump out at you, don't they?
Very vivid.
The white walls with those windows there, very dark, almost black.
Johnny?
Black, yes, black. I shall need to get the black out.
Johnny?
Black.
Johnny?
Black. Black. Black for the sky and the sea. Black. All black, like the procession of night that leads us into the valley of despair. Black. Where are we sleeping tonight, Mother? In Father's grave. We try to hide, but he claims us in the end. He always claims us. Death! Death! Death!
I think we better go home now, dear.
So cold, the snow. So cold. All this so futile. I'm blind. The gulls have plucked out my eyes. We crawl on our knees towards our doom.
And it's quite interesting because at the time of doing it, and even now still, you know, obviously there was never any racial connotations in it at all. But you do sometimes think, you know, if I'm in somewhere and someone's talking about the character, I'm thinking, I probably shouldn't start shouting black, black, black at the top of my voice. But, you know, yes, I mean, the really lovely thing about the Fast Show is that people do still love it, and that those kind of catchphrases and characters still live on. I mean, the phrase that I use most is, and then I did a marvellous recording for a podcast, which was nice.
It is the
most useful middle class catchphrase.
Yeah, it is. Yes. Mark Williams, that one, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Mark actually was the one of us that probably stuck most closely to the idea of the Fast Show, which is keep it very, very short, you do your funny thing, you say your catchphrase, and you're off.
Yeah.
You don't get involved in longer areas. And he came up with loads of great little characters like that. This like Jesse's diets, yes.
Yeah, I've mostly been eating.
Yeah. And people still use that a lot.
This week I have been mostly eating Bourbon biscuits.
And Scorchio, of course.
Is
still used by weather forecasters. Yeah. And, you know, there will come a time when perhaps some of these phrases will still be used, but the farce show itself has been lost in the mists of time.
Not to us, Charlie. Hope absolutely not.
I'm talking like 2 or 3 million years.
Oh, yeah. 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 When those Mexican aliens are actually in charge of everything.
And there'll be people living in their domes on Mars, and they'll look out and say, Scorchio.
Rob, we said we daren't mention this one because it's a bit rude. Yes. Might as well. Your character, when I don't know whether he had a name or anything. Whenever he crouched down or moved slightly,
I know where this one's going. Yes.
Yes, are you ready to order?
I think so. Yes. I'll have the chef's pate and also the grilled. Oh, I'm sorry. I've just come. The grilled scallops. And for main course, I'll have roast rack of. I do beg your pardon, I've just come again. The roast rack of lamb.
And I'll have lamb's kidney. Sorry, I've just come.
And for wine, sir?
So, no, it's all right. Could you just order us a taxi, please? We've both just come.
No, he never had a name.
No.
He never had a name. When I first saw that, I didn't know what it meant.
So the first time that happened to you, you thought, it all makes sense now.
Yes, I dare say I didn't have quite such a casual revelation.
Absolutely. Yeah. You wrote an episode of Marple, didn't you?
I did, yes.
And you played James Bond.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yes, and actually, the whole reason I got the job was because of the James Bond connections. Because the Mammoth, the company that made them, they approached me and they said, "We're making the new Miss Marples, and what we're trying to do in the stuff we're making now is set them in a specific time, and if possible, put in an actual person from that time." Into the story to sort of root it and give it an extra layer of interest. And they said, we've got this one that we've never done before with the new team, which is Caribbean Mystery, which is the only time that Miss Marple ever leaves England. Mm. And they said, you know, we want to set it, it's kind of in the early 50s, and it would be great if Miss Marple met Ian Fleming. And they said, so we thought of you. Which was nice. and they said, would I like to have a go at writing it? I said, well, that'd be brilliant. Yeah. And as I was writing it, I thought, well, if I'm putting Ian Fleming in, it'd be good to put James Bond in as well. Yeah. And obviously the famous, who knows if it's actually, it's true because there's lots of other candidates for the job, but Ian Fleming always claimed that he was looking for a name for James Bond, and he was really into nature and bird watching, and he loved snorkeling and any sort of observations of nature. And he looked up on his shelf and he had this book, Birds of the West Indies by James Bond. So I thought of a scene whereby at the hotel where Miss Marple's staying, they're having a talk about Birds of the West Indies being given by James Bond. Ian Fleming turns up to the talk and, you know, they have a discussion with Miss Marple. What's he doing there? Oh, you know, I'm working on this little spy story or whatever. It's a bit corny, but fun. And he says, but you know, I'm just looking for a name. At which point James Bond comes on stage, a real American ornithologist who says, good evening. My name's Bond, James Bond. and we see Ian Fleming think, oh, and sort of scribble something down in his notebook. It's a bit of fun. And I thought nothing more of it. You know, give them the script. Eventually they get around to making it and they're very pleased with it all. And it's all filmed in South Africa. And actually, one of the great things about writing that script originally was that I didn't have to worry about anything other than the writing. As I say, and on most of the projects I do, I end up sort of show running, which means you are responsible for absolutely everything. And so it's quite stressful and it's a lot of work. So the idea of just writing a script and giving it to the production company, you knew exactly what they're doing. So they make hundreds of these bloody things. You don't have to worry about that side of things. And I could sit at home, you know, carrying on doing something else. And I would start to get reports of like, you know, people go to South Africa because it's reliably sunny all year round. And it looks like there's bits of it that look like almost anywhere else in the world, including sort of suburban England. So a lot of advertisers, for instance, in the winter will go and film an English advert. But of course, it was pissing with rain. And I kept getting these reports back. Oh, God, this is impossible. It's just raining the whole time. We've used up all our wet weather cover. Because what you do is if you're doing exterior scenes, you will build into the day. If it's raining, we'll go into here and film this bit. And you've got like a 3-week shoot. And they said after 2 days, we've used up all our wet weather cover. After 2 days, we don't know what to do. But they soldiered on. And I thought, it's not my problem. They'll make it and it'll be fine. And I won't need that day-to-day stress. And then they rang up and said, look, we think it would be quite fun if you played James Bond. And I thought, I'm never going to get this offer again. Yeah. So I was put on a plane and flown down to South Africa, where it was pissing with rain. And they were still trying to film outdoors under these huge plastic sheets and things. And yes, I got to be James Bond. And you know, the fun thing, if you're on a film shoot or a TV shoot, you get your trailer, which is usually a sort of long caravan with which has got three different little dressing rooms in it. And they don't put the actor's name on the door. They put the character name.
Oh,
so it said James Bond.
Oh.
And I made sure to get photographed outside it. And yes, I do have a credit now on IMDb as James Bond.
The seventh James Bond.
Yeah.
It's a pub quiz question waiting to happen, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it all got very meta.
Very quickly, I should imagine. It's so amazing. Is there any, was across all the amazing projects you've been involved with, is there any of all, because obviously found so many of them just almost unbearably funny. Is there any that you just almost couldn't complete filming because it was just on the set, it was just almost too hard to complete? I know you're all the greatest professionals, but was there a moment that was just too tough?
I was terrible doing any filming with Vic and Bob because I was such fans of theirs.
Yeah.
And then I'd be in a sketch with them and I'd just be laughing at what they were doing. I mean, like when we did the sketch with the Swiss Tony sketch where they were the characters called the bra men who are convinced that everybody's trying to look at their bras. And even though they're obviously not wearing bras, and they go to a car, secondhand car dealer, and they're trying to buy a car. And combination of me doing this stupid voice and them doing their characters, I just couldn't get through it.
Swiss Tony's. This is the place, dude.
Right. Look, there's a car, Pat.
It is a car. It's a nice brown car. It's got hinges, Dave.
That's got a gear stick. A bit out of the way, man.
It is a bit of a queer spot.
Hello! Good afternoon, Swiss Tony.
Hello, Swiss. We've heard a lot about you, but not all of it good.
Anyway, it's Pat here. He wants a car, someone for him to get about in. Isn't that right, Pat?
That's right, Swiss. Now, he wants windows that wind up and then wind back down again.
You know, I want to be able to have air outside the car as well as inside, Tony.
Very wise, sir. Very wise indeed.
Yes, you're quite right. Now, it must be eye-catching. That's right. Like, you know, like a kingfisher's eye-catching.
Oh, that's very eye-catching, a kingfisher, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very eye-catching bird indeed, sir.
Is there anything I've missed out, Pat?
Wipers.
Pat?
Not in front of Swiss Tony. It's about time you learn how to wipe yourself as well, isn't it?
Dear man, windscreen wipers! Oh, he wants windscreen wipers. Now, that's our requirements, Tony. Can you sort us out?
You want something airy, spacious, and eye-catching. Have you considered a convertible at all?
Oh, yes! Lovely car. Look at that!
Suits you down to the ground, sir.
I know.
You know, nice. I can picture you now, driving along in the summer with your top down.
Hey! I want to take a fella who'll drive along with me brass on. Hey, you want a car salesman, not a pimp?
Exactly. Come on, Jim. Let's not hang around talking to this pervert.
Hi, and you can stick your car
away.
It's my car stolen. I'll just go and call the police. Then I'll get back to my eggs.
And it's actually it's a nightmare on set when that happens because you've you've got like 50 people.
Many people there, yeah.
Staring at you, thinking, "Well, we've got to get this fucking sketch finished today." What's he laughing at? And you know, it's like being a kid again. It's like laughing in church. That the more you know you're not supposed to be doing it, the more you do it. And it ended up, you know, a lot of the shots, because, you know, comedy is usually works best if you're seeing action and reaction in the same shot. So two shots and three shots are really good rather than cutting from a single to a single. But most of that sketch is shot on singles because I think in the end, I probably had to be removed from set so they could do their line. And again, there's another one of it's one of my favorite sketches of theirs, which is the weird sort of southerners with a melon patch and they're drinking black milk and I'm this strange American interviewer. And exactly the same thing happened on that. Luckily I didn't laugh in the sketch where I'm taking monkeys to be baptized and their characters, I can't remember what they're called, but they keep always trying to get out of the car and they can't open the doors because they're parked next a tree or something. And they get into a dispute with me, and my car has got monkeys in the back. And there's lots of the shots of the monkeys sort of going. And then I have a heart attack and say, there's a voiceover. It's something like, who will take my monkeys to be baptized now that I'm dead? But I didn't laugh in that one.
Now that I am gone, who will take my precious monkeys to be baptized?
But I'm knowing on the Fast Show, most of the time we didn't corpse. We got on with it.
Right.
But I tell you, one of the hardest sketches to film is one that it's kind of my favorite. It's a lot of people's favorite one. It's the Ted and Ralph drinking game sketch.
Oh yeah, please. Yeah.
And we filmed that in a lovely, well, very characterful pub. We were up, I think we were on the North York Moors or somewhere.
Yeah.
And location filming particularly is quite grueling. Now you're up every day, very early, out and about, hard work. And because Paul and I are producing, we've got to be there, you know, for every second of that filming. So, and it was the end of the day. We came, finally got round to getting to this pub, and inevitably we were probably already running about 2 hours late. Everybody's exhausted, cold and wet, and we got this sketch to do. And Paul and I knew, well, everybody knew in it, that it was a good sketch, that it was a funny sketch. We worked very hard on those scripts. And we started filming it. Now, if you're filming a sketch and one person is not quite sure of their lines, it usually doesn't matter too much because everyone else is there and you've got the structure and they've got the cues and you can sort of pick it up. But it soon became clear that none of us had learnt their lines properly. Because of this bloody drinking game,
yes.
Of when you're supposed to say aubergine and potato, tomato, and so again, you know what I'm saying about the you know, you want a group shot when they're all doing the names of the vegetables and bouncing off each other, but you know it would be, sorry, aubergine, what tomato is it? Oh, start again, and Mark Mylod, the director, brilliant director, who was the lead director on Succession. So he's gone on to great things in the world.
Amazing.
You know, he was getting really frustrated. And we're just thinking, you know, time is ticking away. The crew are going to want to go home any minute now. And we're just thinking, oh, Christ, you know, we've cocked this up. It'd be a disaster. And Mark just got the cameraman and said, right, point the camera at him. He'd say, right, say potato. Potato. Great. Okay. Now say tomato. Tomato. Now say this line. And he literally had to go around singles all around the table doing that. But once it's all, you know, the dust has settled and you get round to actually editing it, it's fine. It worked. And you know, sometimes the sketches that are most fun to film are the ones that at least fun to watch. and vice versa. So, you know, we were really pleased in the end that we did manage to capture it.
A lot of it's in Paul's reaction, you know, to receiving the news as well, isn't it?
Well, he's a piece of piss, his job.
Yeah.
He never has to say anything. He just stands there.
Right, yeah.
I wouldn't know about that, sir.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, you know, he always says that he found filming those sketches really boring. You know, he's not able to do a big funny voice and prance about the place.
Yeah, true.
He's just standing there like that. All right, sir. listening to me drone on.
Yeah. So hard to ask.
Yeah, I remember that when that the sort of the final line landed, you know, about his wife, and I remember it being like a kind of comedy I'd never felt or experienced before. Yeah. You know, like such a challenging thing he's being told, but delivered in such an excruciatingly funny way. Yeah. And I remember not knowing how to feel. Yeah. And I suppose that's great, isn't it? You know, like to challenge your audience in that sense, to push a boundary.
If you can take your audience with you and that they sort of trust you and enjoy it, you can push things into interesting areas and take risks.
Right. Ding, ding, round two. Tomato, what? Aubergine, wood. Potato, you. Turnip, light. Carrots, two. Asparagus, drink.
Ho, ho, ho!
Tomato, point. Aubergine, of. Potato, best. Turnip, please!
Ted. Ted, there's something I need to speak to you about.
I nominate Mr. Mayhew.
Sorry?
No,
forfeit. You have to say tomato.
I beg your pardon?
You've got to put a vegetable in front of each word in the right order.
Look, so it goes, right? Tomatoes, aubergine, potato, turnip, carrot, asparagus, then you add one of your own, and then it's back to tomatoes again.
Yes, I'm sorry, I really have no idea what...
No! Forfeit!
Tomato, you, aubergine, have, potato, two, turnip, say, carrot, the, asparagus,
right, broccoli, vegetables. Tomato or aubergine, it's potato, a, turnip, forfeit.
It's a drinking game, sir.
Ted, I really do need... I'm very sorry. Under normal circumstances, believe you me, I would like nothing more than to join you in your game, but not tonight, please.
Go on, sir, go on. It'll be a bit fun, sir.
Ted, really...
Tomato, ears, aubergine, your potato, drinks.
It's all right, we've got a new nominee.
Wahey!
It's just a private matter.
Bong!
tomato, it's... Aubergine A.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Potato, private turnip matter.
Oh, so you're getting the hang of it now, that's right.
That's right, don't be embarrassed, sir. Go on, it's just a little bit of fun.
Tomato, Ted, aubergine, your potato, wife's turnip dead. Sorry, I mean, tomato.
If we take the audience and now turn that into readership.
Yeah.
And we look at, was it 96 when Silverfin came out? Was that?
Have 96, that right? No.
Is it 2006?
Yeah, that sounds more like it, yeah.
2008, sorry.
I've no, I mean, my, I stopped. Decades I, mixed up. You know, I stopped writing books in 94 when the Vase Show sort of started in earnest. And then I picked up again, yeah, early 2000s.
Mm.
My kids were getting to an age where I wanted to be around them a bit more. You know, when they were really small, they don't know whether you're there or not. You know, I mean, it's tough on my wife, but you know, I was able to go away on a lot more location shooting and not be around so much. But once they're at an age where they're, you know, they're at school and, you know, they need support parents, I wanted to be around more and not to be, you know, out of the house at 5 a.m. and back at 10 p.m. So, and I'd done a lot of TV back to back. I was quite knackered, and I was approached out of the blue by a woman called Kate Jones, who had been my editor on my 4 crime books that I wrote in the early 90s that we talked about before. She was working for the Fleming estate, trying to revitalize the literary side of it. And she approached me and said, look, I'm working for the Ian Fleming estate. I can't say too much about this, or top secret, but, you know, would you have any interest in writing a James Bond book? At which point I thought, Christ, how the hell would you go about that? How would you write anything about James Bond that hasn't been written before in all of the novels and the continuation novels and done in all the films? And I think I don't know where to start. They said, well, and she said, no, it's not for an adult, it's young Bond, it's teenage James Bond. At which point I just thought, well, yes, I can see that. I mean, my boys were of the right age to read these books. And I just thought, yeah, I could write an amazing fantasy adventure story that they would really like. And I could just put in all the things that I loved doing when I was that age as a boy and sort of then pumping them up and making them work in the world of James Bond. And I sort of almost had the first book fully formed in my head as before she'd finished the sentence. And I said, God, I would love to do that. So it came at exactly the right time for me because, I mean, she knew my writing inside out and she knew what I was like to work with. And I, like Fleming, I've always been a big fan of American hard-boiled crime fiction, which is very stripped to the bone. It's not, there's not lots of flowery writing and pages of descriptions. It's getting on. It's talking about things. It's using brand names instead of, you know, you don't describe a car over 2 pages. You say it was a 52 pink Buick or whatever. And bang, you know, you've got that in your head. That's all you need. And, you know, punchy writing, lots of action. And so she thought that style of writing would work very well with kids who don't want all that flowery nonsense. And so, yeah, so I sort of came up with the idea for the book. I pitched that to them. They were very pleased with it, at which point I went to, they said, look, can you come down and meet the family and the rest of the estate, the literary estate, Ian Fleming Publications, as they are now. And I said, come to the Fleming building in Berkeley Square. I thought, oh, that's exciting. And there I went to Berkeley Square, which is in Mayfair in West London, this big posh square. And there's this big imposing building with pillars and everything on the outside. And you go inside, there's marble floors and uniformed people everywhere. And I'm thinking, my God, you know, I knew James Bond books had sold a lot, you know, over 120 million. And obviously the films are at the time were the biggest film franchise of all time. I thought, but I didn't know they made this much money. And someone from the estate came to meet me and we're going up in the lift. And I say that to them and they said, oh, no, that's not the James Bond money. That's the banking side of the family. Ian Fleming's grandfather set up one of the first private banks, and Fleming's Bank is this huge private bank that makes billions.
Wow.
They said, this is the literary bit. open a door in a sort of pillar, a fake pillar made out of plaster or something. And there's this little corridor down the side of the building, squashed in with a sort of sloping roof with about four desks in it. And there's about four people working there. So this is the literary side. This is the James Bond bit of the building.
Amazing.
But we did go for lunch at the top of the building. There was essentially a Bond villain's lair, this huge, huge dining room with the longest table you've ever seen, big glass domed ceiling running down it, oil paintings on all the walls, all these sort of staff in these quite old fashioned uniforms, very, very obsequious. It was like, you know, a Bond villain sitting down for his lunch. And I met Fleming's two nieces, Lucy Fleming and Kate Grimmett. You know, it was fantastic to meet people who had known Ian. You know, unfortunately he had one son who committed suicide, and that, so there was no one on directly from him, but his brother Peter, who married Celia Johnson from Brief Encounter, those were their daughters. And so I had a sort of direct connection with Ian, and it was great to talk about them, to talk about him and to talk about the thing. And luckily they liked my ideas, and I talked more about the book and what would happen in it. And it all went from there. So it was really exciting. And then, you know, to sit at my computer and type the words, "The name's Bond, James Bond," was like, you know, what a thrill. I'm thinking, this actually is James Bond. I've been commissioned by the Ian Fleming estate. He's not like, he's not like James Bond's nephew or
James Bond's you.
He's not like Alex Rider, who's he's not Alex Rider, who is essentially is a sort of teenage James Bond, but he isn't. And Anthony Horowitz has confessed that Alex Rider is the illegitimate son of James Bond and Honey Rider from Dr. No. Grandson, not son.
Incredible. Because your boys, your brother Harry has an affinity for Silverfin, doesn't he?
Yeah, so Harry is there's a third, well, there's actually four of us
picking.
But he's a teacher, so he obviously can't be here for this interview, but he's a primary school teacher, and he wanted to let you know, he sent us a message. So when he used to take his class to, they have a library session, even though it was his, he calls it non-contact time, he still went to the library with the class because he wanted to sit down and model what it's like to choose a book and settle down to it for a long time. And he always picked Silverfin off the shelf. And gradually, you know, over time, he made his way through it, chunk at a time. He says he started becoming so engrossed that he forgot his original motivation for going to his class for the library session. So it just became all about Silverfin. but then he says one day he was distraught to find that it wasn't on the shelf.
Someone had taken it out.
A student had taken it out, thankfully. Yeah. So Harry says originally he was dismayed. But then he was like, "Oh, this is brilliant! This is exactly what it was all about." So, yeah, a young mind was dipping the toes into the world of young Bond, presumably for the first time. You know, that got Harry into the series, of course. But he had a question for you, so he put,
"Okay,
it's stereotypically difficult to get young boys into reading and writing, and I know Rob will attest to this, but
yeah,
was that any part of your motivation when writing the series, and as such, what do you think it is about James Bond that appeals to younger readers?"
That's about four questions.
It is, isn't it? I'm only reading that. Sorry,
Charlie. it was a specified aim from the start. When I was talking to Kate, she did say that part of this, that they wanted to work with some literacy organisations, and it was part of a drive to try to get boys to read books. Now, luckily, the James Bond books, like the James Bond films, are enjoyed by both sexes. Let's not go down that route, by boys and girls, men and women. But, you know, my initial thing was, I want to write something that my boys would like, something that I would have liked when I was that age. And in the hope that then you can expand out from that. And yes, it was a time, you know, in the beginning of the noughties, where there was a big discussion, because I mean, what had happened is, you know, traditionally there were lots of adventure books written for boys and very few books written for girls, apart from, you know, things like Shelley School and Mallory Towers and things. Most of children's publishing was quite male-oriented. And in the 70s, there was a big change. People were saying, you know, we shouldn't be encouraging boys to be reading these violent books, these imperialistic, colonialistic books like, you know, Biggles and Tarzan and the like. And, you know, books should be trying to encourage empathy and emotion, and we need to get girls reading because girls weren't reading as much as boys. And so there was a big shift in publishing. A lot of those traditional books and series were kind of quietly removed or pushed into the background. And there were suddenly, you know, there were books about emotions and relationships and things. And lo and behold, girls started to read a lot more. And this was very, very successful. But by the time we got into the 90s, boys weren't bothering to read anymore. But it had been sort of ingrained that, well, we shouldn't be writing books all about fighting and swords and guns and all that nasty stuff. But the fact of the matter is, boys like that stuff. They like books where people are doing things and things are happening, rather than, oh dear, I've dropped my flower baby in a puddle. So, I mean, obviously boys do like those books as well. And as I say, girls really like the James Bond books. So, and I think the big shift actually happened on the back of Harry Potter, because the first thing that did was suddenly it made children's publishing respectable. And people were saying, oh, actually, there's money to be made here. You know, this is a good thing. So different types of writers moved into writing for kids who maybe wouldn't have done traditionally. And then we had the big explosion of these boys' books, if you want to call them that. There was the Owen Colfer's Artemis Fowl series. There was Darren Shan's Vampire series. And obviously there was Anthony Horowitz's Alex Rider series. And suddenly boys were lapping these books up. You know, this is horror. This is guns, car chases. This is fantasy in the case of Owen Colfer. So there was this big upsurge, which is one of the reasons that the Flemings thought, hang about, you know, we've got James Bond. We've got the real deal. Let's do this. And let's try and get boys reading. And it worked. You know, I mean, I have a lot of feedback. I mean, the James Bond books are still in the schools and still in the libraries, and they're still read a lot by kids, my young Bond books. And I, you know, and I get a lot of feedback of like, oh, I couldn't get this boy to read, so I gave him this, and now he's an avid reader. He reads everything. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason that those books have lasted and not dated is that they were set in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So even when I was writing them, they were set in this sort of, in a sort of fantasy world. So as far as a kid is concerned, the 1930s is the mists of time. So they're as interested in the workings of that world as everything else. And you know, as you know, nothing dates faster than something which is absolutely contemporary. Bang up to date with today's slang and kids playing today's great computer games, video games. 2 years down the line, a new kid comes along. Oh, that game's really old-fashioned. Yeah. My big brother used to play that. Oh, nobody uses that word anymore. And suddenly you've got a really dated book, but you go back to Eton in the 1930s and, you know, it's like Hogwarts. It's a fantasy environment.
I realise we haven't really got to the book.
Yeah, what I'm supposed to be talking about.
Yeah.
It's just been a great chat, I know. So on His Majesty's Secret Service, yes. I mean, yeah, Matt's got a copy there. I inhaled it on three separate things. I listened to yourself read it on Kindle, enjoyed the hardcover, and on Audible, I listened to yourself. Read on Kindle at night and hardcover as well. So, yeah, you narrated the audiobook as well. That must have been quite interesting.
Well, they asked me if I wanted to do that halfway through when I was writing it. And I thought, yeah, I do actually, because the book is for charity.
Mm.
And so I'm not making a penny out of it. And I thought, oh, if I do the audiobook, they'll have to pay me. So my fee for doing the audiobook is my monetary reward, my rewards for, you know, is that I was allowed to write an adult James Bond, which is amazing.
Well, I mean, it's just amazing.
But yeah, I mean, at that point, I said, yeah, I'd like to do that. At which point I thought, oh, my God, I've got a South African character. I've got a woman from Iceland. Who the hell knows how the Icelandics speak? And I got all these other characters. And I got, oh, Christ, I've got them. At that point, one of the characters was a Geordie. And I know I can just about scrape by doing some of the others, but no way can I do a Geordie. So I changed him. as I was writing it, because I thought, I had the same problem with the Young Bond books, which I also did. I did the sort of abridged audio versions of, and because Bond's all adventuring around the world, you know, suddenly I've got a conversation between an Indian boy, a Russian, and an Irishman, and I've got to switch between them as I'm doing the bloody scene. It's impossible. I have to sort of do a sort of light version of the accents, because in the end they're hiring it because this is Charlie Higson reading it. It's not an anonymous person who can do amazing voices. And I found it actually reading books to my kids when I was little. I would always do a big performance and try and do funny voices for everything. And then they would say, can Mum read this book to me? Why? Because it's her reading it. She's not doing all these. That's what you want as a kid, is your mum to read to you, your dad to read to you, not Donald Duck to read to you. It's me telling the story. I can't remember what the question was.
How did it come about? How did they approach you again? Yeah, did the Flying State come to you again?
Well, you know, this year is the 70th anniversary of Casino Royale. It is also the first year that IFP are publishing the James Bond books themselves. They've set up their own imprint. It's not going out through another big publisher. And over the years, you know, the James Bond rights have bounced about all over the place, and they've slowly been pulling everything in the same way that Eon has done with all the screen rights. So they're big celebrations for the 70th anniversary, great new covers for the series. It's a big deal. And then, you know, I've been in touch with them over the years and you know, been involved in the world of Bond pretty much nonstop. And so I know them very well. And Corinne Turner, who's kind of in charge, gets in touch, says, Charlie, you know, we're doing all these celebrations. And she said, but it's also the 60th anniversary of on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And obviously we've got the coronation this year. This is February of this year that she approached me. And she said, we really want to do something called On His Majesty's Secret Service. We don't know what it is, but we've all discussed it, and the family and the estate and everything. And they said, well, if anyone's going to do anything, we want you to do it because you know this inside out. You know, could you come up with an idea? And she said, we want to do it for charity. We want to do it for the two of the royal charities. We want to do it for the Prince's Trust and for Camilla's got a new literacy charity. I could never remember the name of and it's got something like the Queen's Library. And, you know, we could do it for them. So, probably best not to think of a story based around disrupting the coronation or assassinating Charles or anything like that. At which point, once again, a story leaps fully formed into my mind. I said, look, Corinne, I'm sorry, but that's got to be the story.
Yeah, it has to be, doesn't it? It's got to be.
She said, all right. So she goes back to the charities and they said, well, we can't really be seen to be endorsing a story about trying to kill Charles, particularly Camilla's charity. So that switched to the National Literacy Trust, which is a charity I do a lot of work with, and Camilla also does a lot of work with. So that actually worked out fine. But they said, you know, probably, you know, because this was February, they said they want to launch it to be published and in the shops 2 days before the coronation, which is May. So they said, you know, it's probably going to be a short story. And then, you know, we'll make it a proper book. We'll put in extracts from the On Her Majesty's, and maybe put some extracts from one of your Bond books, because there's a bit in by Royal Command where he meets the Queen when she's a little girl, playing in a gardens in the house they had in Windsor Park, which was based on my father-in-law had that very experience.
Oh, wow.
So I nicked that. And so, yeah, they said we put that and we put some interviews in and some other stuff and we'll make it look like a proper book. So I start writing it and I come up with the idea of what the story is going to be so that the estate and the board can look at it. And so at the end of February, they agreed. They said, yeah, great, write this story. So I sat down at the beginning of March to start writing a short story. And then I thought, oh, it would be great if this happened and then that happened and this happened and that happened. And before I knew it, I had it's a novella. It is about the same length as I think the couple of the shortest things that, that's
right.
Short stories. Although I'm not sure how long Man with the Golden Gun is, but yeah, it's not long. But the great thing about the Fleming books is he hit on this fantastic structure, this way of writing them that cuts out a huge amount of fat. Essentially, the book starts, Bond goes in to see M. M says, this is the villain. He's up to something here to do with gold. Can you go and sort it out and deal with him? So all the complicated spying work and putting all that information together, which would normally in a spy novel or a detective novel, that would be your first half to two thirds of the book. That's all been done. It's all in a file that N gives to Bond and off he goes. And he meets the villain and he kills him and comes back again. And that's it. There's no complicated double crossing or double agents or amazing twists and turns in the story. He just gets on with the job and does it and comes back.
I'll tell you how refreshing that was.
Yeah.
You know, like after the recent, Bond films, I have to be honest, I can't tell you how wonderful it was to get that scene with M and going, what do you know about this chap? Oh, this chap. Yeah. Well, in fact, I know, 800 exactly. pages worth of facts about the guy.
And it doesn't come across as exposition. It's just someone telling you what your job is.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's brilliant. And as long as you stick to that structure, and again, Umberto Eco famously described it as a series of chess moves. And you put all those things in. You put the Bond woman, you put the villain and the sidekick. You've got his plot, his lair. Bond gets involved with him. There's a bit early on where he kind of thwarts him or his men, but then he goes to the lair, he gets captured, he's tortured, he escapes, he kills everyone, he comes home. So I had that structure, so I didn't have to think about that. All I had to do was come up with good elements to put into that. And I had recently returned from a trip to Budapest, which is a lovely city.
Yeah, lovely. Yeah.
And I'd really enjoyed it, and people were so friendly and nice. And, I remember thinking when I was there, you wouldn't know it, meeting these people and going around the streets. And, it's very civilized that, this guy Orban is in charge, who's perhaps not as democratic as some other leaders. And I thought, well, okay, I can put that into the book and it's a perfect place to set the story. They've got castles, so I can put these lair in a nice old castle. So I had that and I put that in. And so once you then got the villain and the idea for the Bond girl, Bond woman, and it just kept building and building. And I remember, so I wrote it in a month, which was March.
Incredible.
And I remember I had a deadline and I was just about to get to it. And I rang up the guy at IFP, Simon Ward, who deals with the editorial side. I said, "Is it all right if I'm a couple of days late, because I really want to put a car chase in?"
Yes.
He said, yeah, go for it. The more this looks like a proper book, the better. So I did. And I, from that sort of central nugget, I was able to bolt these bits on and expand it into being what I hope is a good, fun, just straight down the line Bond adventure.
It is, Charlie. Truthfully, listeners to this podcast will know that I found the last few years of being a Bond fan quite tough. And so this ticked so many boxes for me, and it gave me a Bond adventure I've been craving for quite some time. So on that sense, I'm really grateful. And it was great to see Bond in a contemporary setting being James Flipping Bond, and that's what I really wanted to see.
I mean, I had always thought that if I was ever given the adult Bond job, and watching it go to Sebastian Foulkes and William Boyd and Anthony Horowitz, all these great writers, and thinking, well, maybe one day they'll ask me.
Yeah.
I'd always thought if I did, it would be a continuation of the young Bond timeline. I'd always thought of doing the story of him at the beginning of the war, getting involved in Secret Service and earning his 00 status and all of that. So it would be a continuation. And I thought, oh, I'm not sure I could do a contemporary Bond. But when we did it, and the idea was, okay, it's about the coronation and it will be published. In fact, the opening scene takes place on the day that the book was published and was in the shops. So yes, I've completely broken my rule of don't make things too contemporary, because but actually when I sat down to write it, I just thought, this is actually great. And to keep it enough in Fleming's world and enough of the character, but also to take on board, well, he's a 35-year-old man today. He's not going to be the same as a 35-year-old man in 1952-53, who is a product of the Second World War, which the original Bond was, and which Fleming was. And you know, those books are about what happened in the war as much as anything else. So he's going to be different from that, but he still needs to be recognisably Ian Fleming's James Bond, and driven by the same things and with the same kind of basic outlook. And you know, if you read the book, that's what he is. There's been a lot of people, I'll call them, on Twitter, as we used to call it, but old duffers like me, I can't keep up. What's it called now?
No, yes,
eggs or something. you know, saying, and you know, they've read one page, which a couple of people have posted. It's like, well, James Bond can't be woke, and you think, well, why not? Why can't he be woke? As long as he's still James Bond, as long as he's still involved in the action, he's getting off with a beautiful woman, he's killing people, he's doing his job. Why can't he eat kimchi and drink kombucha? And, you know, and James Bond always was someone who hated extremists. He hated people who were messing things up for everyone else. And he would have hated left wing as much as right wing.
Yeah. I was amazed at the criticism.
All that amazed me
really
was it took them, you know, the book came out in May.
And the timing was weird.
I was expecting at the time, when is this going to happen? Didn't happen. I thought, oh, that's interesting. It becomes a Sunday Time bestseller. People love it.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, months later, these people are like, as if this book didn't exist before. And suddenly it's leapt into their world, and I've killed James Bond.
Sorry if it was our fault, because we did a post on it, and then that seemed all helpful.
No, it was Ed West, this guy Ed West, who is he's a journalist. He may well YouTube. He's a journalist who writes for the, and I always get them confused, which is the right-wing one, The Spectator or The New Statesman?
I think it was The Spectator.
Spectator.
Right.
And he posted without any comment. It was a page from the book, and I think he kind of circled a couple of things in red.
I remember it.
And he knows who his followers are. He knew he didn't have to say anything. And they all picked up on it. And, you know, by your followers, you shall be known. And you look at these followers and their timelines and you think, Ed, are you happy that these are the people that love you? You know, it was fine. More people know about the book now than used to. But, you know, it struck me very much like, because originally it was, you know, it was the right wingers saying, oh, Bond's gone all woke. He doesn't like right wingers. And then it was someone else posted another page which mentions that one of the guys in this kind of conspiracy against Charles is a disgraced politician who, one of the things he said the wrong thing about in the trans debate. So then I had all the sort of the trans debaters on board as well. So it was really interesting seeing all this stuff. I mean, I basically just mute people. Occasionally will say something polite like thank you for your interest, and then I'll mute them. So they're probably all out there still screaming at me.
I couldn't understand, because for me this is actually, it was factually inaccurate, you know, and it was painfully obvious that it was just that particular sequence. The phrase in it that I remember that signpost is that make Hungary great again thing. You know, like that within two, so factually they're going on about that, you know, that's something they're very obsessed about. And look how, you know, woke James Bond is now. Within a page and a half, Bond is, his internal monologue is, you know, decrying someone for doing, you know, he's saying, you know, you can't do that. That's for pussies, which is a notoriously unwoke thing to say, you know, or to even think, you know, and it just became very obvious that a flag had been waved about this particular bit without ever taking in the wider context of the piece.
It's the interesting thing is, you know, when we were making comedy, people would love it, laugh along and think, great, until you do a joke about something that's close to their heart.
Yeah.
I mean, the one that always gets people up in arms is if anything to do with Christianity, for instance. Suddenly it's like, I really like the show, it's really funny, but this is terrible, you can't be doing this. And you wouldn't say this about the Muslims, you know, and things like that. And it's exactly the same with Bond, you know, because I've mentioned a couple of things that are close to their heart. It's the Mitchell and Webb sketch. It's the two SS officers. It's like,
yeah.
Do you think we are the bad guys?
Yes. Hans, I've just noticed something.
These communists are all cowards.
Have you looked at our caps recently?
Our caps?
The badges on our caps. Have you looked at them?
What? No. A bit.
They've got skulls on them. Have you noticed that our caps have actually got little pictures of skulls on them?
I don't,
Hans, are we the baddies?
These people out there can't bear the fact that Bond might think that they're a bunch of tossers.
Yeah.
coming to gun for them. You know, they claim it's like, oh, this is badly written or something, but... No, it's not. It's because it defends their, you know, James Bond is taking pot shots at their bubble.
Yes. And I are Christians, but we love Life of Brian. You know, you've got to laugh. Yeah. You can't laugh at yourself.
The Kumbaya sketch in... that's Fast Show, isn't it? That's you guys.
Yes, it was the Christian Coppers.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant, that one.
Hello. Oh, excuse me, can you help me? I've just come from the park. Someone just came up and took off with my dog.
Right, yes, hold on a minute, madam. George, there's a lady here who says she's looking for eternal salvation in the Lord.
I didn't say that. I said someone came up and took off with my dog.
Right, scratch that, George. She's changed her mind. Dog, you say, madam. Right, what's its name?
It's a she. She is called Jess. Jess.
Right, so that's J... E-S-U-S.
No, she's called Jess and you've just written Jesus.
So I have. Still, it's a lovely word, isn't it? Jesus. Jesus. He died for all our sins, you know, madam. Oh, right, sorry, madam. So you say you were in the park when you lost little Jesse. Right.
Would that be the park... by the church, madam?
No, the one by the lake.
Yeah, but you can see the Church of Our Lady from there, now, can't you, madam?
Can you? Yeah. In that case, madam, would you have been able to hear the faithful singing from there, something like this? Kumbaya, my lord, kumbaya, kumbaya. Would you have been able to hear anything like that, madam?
I suppose so.
Mm. And if you had heard it, how loudly would they have been singing? Would it have been sort of kumbaya, my lord, kumbaya? Or more sort of... Oh, Lord, Kumbaya!
All right. Well, look, if they had been singing from where I was, it would have been about as loud as, Kumbaya, my Lord, Kumbaya!
Kumbaya!
Could be
dead.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, the identity kit thing as well.
Yeah.
Where Arabella's in the hospital bed or something. And he looked like this and he looked like that. And he's drawing the thing and then turns out, do you look like this, madam? And it's a stereotypical drawing of Christ. She said, no.
Yeah.
No, not like that. Why have you drawn that? Well, it's our Lord Jesus Christ.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're not.
These people. We're not,
exactly. And I've got absolutely nothing against Christians or Christianity, but you just make, you know, you make jokes and you have a laugh, and you know, it's like, who do they want James Bond's villain to be? But it is actually, you know, it's a really interesting thing because Fleming himself, he started out in the first six books, five, I think, going up to from Russia with Love, the enemy. The villains were very much communist Russia, Soviet Russia.
Yeah.
And he made no bones about that. But after that book, he comes up with Spectrum. He comes up with the idea of an international apolitical crime organization. And he said, oh, I think I need to stop ragging the Russians. They're actually quite nice people. And but he also knew that things were changing. And he thought in a couple of years' time, the Russians could well be our friends again, in which case I don't want to keep knocking them in the books. So he comes up very, very cleverly, this international crime organization. So he's creating his own villains. He's not using it. It moves away from being political. And that's what they pretty much stuck to in the films. Because they want their films to be seen in China, so they're not going to have a go at the Chinese. They want the films to be seen in India, so they're not going to, you know, they steer scrupulously steer clear of politics, except for a couple of times, like in the Timothy Dalton, the Living Daylights, which is in Afghanistan, And again, the villains are Russians, although if you use the Russians, they tend to be, it's a rogue general. We're trying to build bridges with the people in charge, but this rogue general is fighting for the good old days of Soviet Russia.
Yeah, so he's not you, don't worry. You know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, who do they come up with as the great guys who's going to help Bond? You know, it's the Mujahideen.
Yeah.
Who, you know, and that didn't really go well.
and it's a
really difficult thing in anything, and particularly in James Bond, is who is your villain?
Yeah.
What is the crime? What have they done wrong? What makes them a bad person? And that's really difficult. And you know, this is why zombies are really useful, for instance. You know, I could write my horror series about zombies because they're dead people and they have no spokesman.
Yeah.
They're not going to go on Newsnight saying, you know, I think it's an interesting book, but I do think the portrayal of the zombies in it is problematic. We're not all cannibals. So, yeah, so coming up the villain is a really tough one. And how can you really keep it away from politics? It's very tricky. But, you know, when I came to write the book, that's probably a good place to stop. When I came to write the book, and I talked before about, you know, you got the structure, you got all the elements, you put all those elements in, and I thought I can do all that, but I don't want it just to be an exercise in doing a pastiche of Bond. I thought I want this to actually be about something, to be about what's going on in the world today. And so, you know, I'm not a fan of sort of populist nationalism, but also I'm making a podcast at the moment, History of the English Monarchy, Willie Harry Stee, which you must all listen to.
Yes, of course.
And I'd been doing a lot of research about the whole sort of the legitimacy of the succession to the throne, and how over the years it's been usurped and people have come in and kicked other people off and killed them. And you know, we imported some people from Germany to try and make it all work. And I liked that idea. I wanted to go back and bring my villain is someone who's purporting to be a supporter of the Anglo-Saxon, the proper monarchy before the bloody French came and took over. And I thought that was interesting. And I thought that was fun to have that. And for the book to be about how people can manipulate this violent nationalist populist energy that is out there and can manipulate that for their own ends, which is what the villain is doing in the book. So I thought, sod it, I'm going to make this book about something.
Well, we did think that Athelstan the baddie, he's so good because, I mean, he's a bit like Elliot Carver in Tomorrow Never Dies, which was very prescient about controlling the media. But in GoldenEye as well, you know, the Sean Bean character, he has this sort of backstory where it's about the Enns Cossacks and his family betrayed him, Bond betrayed him.
Yes.
Then it Pierce's line at the end. In the end, you're just a bank robber. I want money and I want to take over the
financial world. Gain. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that happens a lot over the course of Bond. So I thought it was a really good way of doing a contemporary baddie who we can all identify with.
Yeah.
He's using those people who are easily manipulated for his own ends. And he might not even believe in any of this nonsense.
Yeah, it's just, yeah.
He sort of confesses it, doesn't he, at the end? He's like, yeah. Oh, no, I don't think I'll be on the throne. I'm not stupid enough to believe that. Yeah. Well, firstly, have you been approached? Is this going to be...
Yeah.
Please tell me that they're going to use this as the basis for Bond 26. Come on.
It's very interesting, the world of Bond. You have these two family firms, family businesses, who both think they invented the product. And actually, neither of them can exist now without the other. I mean, the Bond books obviously came first, but they are, have remained popular and have remained sort of big sellers because of the films. Yeah. So they are both dependent on the other. But Eon, who make the films, they like to control the films and what they do. They don't really want, you know, obviously they do have to keep paying the literary estate for using the character. They've gone beyond using all the actual stories. So they don't really necessarily want to be caught up with trying to get rights from for a new book. They want to be able to grow that themselves. And also, as I say, they want to steer clear of politics, and they would not want, they would not really want to contemplate the political side of the book. They could, I mean, yeah, they could, you could change it. But yeah, you know, they do their thing, and the literary side do their thing. You know, what was really interesting, what you were saying there, you know, which is obviously coming from a great depth of knowledge about Bond and the different plots and the different villains and the similarities or whatever, talking about the old films and going back to the books, obviously, is it I would say probably 99.999% of the weird people who got cross about my book without reading it have no real knowledge of Bond and who he is and where he come from. They might, you know, they would have seen maybe the last couple of Daniel Craig films or whatever, but they have their idea in their head what Bond is, and everybody does. We all do. And we all have a sense of ownership, and we all, you know, we're all Alan Partridge's, you know, why do they keep getting it wrong? If only they'd listen to me. And we project our own fantasies onto Bond. We always have done. And so anything that someone does, another version of Bond that doesn't correspond with the fantasy image that you've created in your head of what Bond is, which has got nothing to do with Fleming or history of the films, is that causes people's wiring to start fizzing and burning out.
Well, you probably described some of us at the recent films, actually, I have to say.
nobody is more critical of anything to do with James Bond than the biggest fans. Yeah. I'm the same. You know, the kind of the stresses on Eon of making those films. You'd think by now Eon have been making films since forever. Mm. And this has been, they've successfully managed to keep this franchise at the top for a huge amount of time. Nobody else has come close to doing that for such a length of time. Mm. You would think when they come to make a new film, the studio says, great, make the film, give it to us. No, doesn't happen. They keep having to change studios. They'll be dealing with a bunch of 20-something executives. And again, they all have their idea of what Bond is and what it should be. And they've got to keep fighting their corner every time making these films. And that they have the energy to carry on is amazing. And we can criticize, and we can say, well, that wasn't how I would have done it. I mean, certainly my feeling about the last film, and you touched on it before, is that there were only a few bits in it where he was allowed to be James Bond.
Yeah.
Like the sequence in Cuba was fantastic.
Mm.
The car chase in Scandinavia, where it was, that was brilliant. But particularly that Cuban sequence, that's classic Bond. And they showed, there's a woman in there, but she's not a ditzy, you know, she's not Britt Eklund. She's tough in her own right. And they've got a great scene. Everything you want from a Bond film. It's funny. It's witty. There's great chemistry between him and her. And, you know, it's a great sequence. And you think, if only they could have just made more of that through the film. But you can see that they've got it and they've got a story. And then, oh, we've got to get this bit in. And how about we do this bit? And it starts to get out of control, but you know, it my little book, the few comments I got on Twitter, imagine what it's like for them. The storm of comments and stuff, and trying to deal with all this crap. So you know, I say hats off to Ian for managing to survive this amount of time and to keep making films that everyone wants to see and everyone talks about.
There's always another one around the corner eventually. and we'll probably like that one. But reading your book after we've sort of been like, oh gosh, where's Bond going to next in the films? It was so refreshing how traditional it was. That's why the criticism seems so ironic to me, that we're praising it because it was back to the traditional James Bond that we have in our heads. And yes, it is.
Yeah, but also trying to keep, make it contemporary at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I will say, when we did the launch for the book in London, in town, and there were two people there who worked for Eon, and they brought two copies up for me to sign. They said, Could you sign one for Barbara and one for Michael? So,
oh, wow.
Whether they just want the complete set on their bookshelves or whether they'll actually read them, I don't know.
Sure. I was very
pleased that they would at least.
Yeah.
That's so awesome. That's completely awesome. Last thing, who would you pick to be James Bond next in the world of the movies?
It's an impossible thing. I mean, I really like James Norton. I think he could make a great Bond. But because he's already been discussed as a possible Bond, that means he won't be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for everything, Charlie. It's brilliant. And whenever, listeners, whenever, for my money, and I'll only speak for myself, but whenever Charlie Higson has James Bond, the property of James Bond in his hand, they're good hands for our hero to be.
Well, thank you. So. I can't tell you how much fun it was writing that book. And just, you know, I channeled Fleming, who famously wrote the books very quickly because he had it all stored in his head, which is what I did. You know, I had a lifetime of adult James Bond and it just went bang down on the page. And that was huge fun. And I've been really, really pleased that particularly the Bond fans have liked it.
Absolutely loved it. Absolutely.
Love of Bond shows, doesn't it?
Yeah, love of Bond shows, yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Well, cheers. Charlie. Been great to speak to you all.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Charlie. Appreciate it. And seriously, honestly, the enjoyment you've given us over the years, man. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Well,
British end.
Thank you all. Cheers. Yeah.
Take care, mate.
Ta-da. Really?
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.